Welcome to the Materials Universe podcast, where we will explore the materials world and how it shapes our lives. My name is Bailey Tibbett, and I will be your host this season. Please join me as I interview researchers from the Center for Dynamics and Control of Materials at the University of Texas at Austin. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Materials Universe podcast. This is your host, Bailey Tibbett, and I'm here with Dr. Eric Anslin today, who is a professor in the Department of Chemistry at UT Austin. He's a Welch Regents Chair in Chemistry and a distinguished teaching professor. We're really excited to have you, Dr. Anslin. Welcome.
My pleasure. Delighted to be here.
And as always, this is Audrey Colgrove, the producer of the podcast, joining in. All right. So today we wanted to start by just asking about your research. Would you mind giving us a brief introduction about your work as it's related to the MRSAC?
Sure. So I would call myself a physical organic chemist or a supramolecular chemist. It basically means a person who's involved in studying the mechanisms and how Mother Nature basically undergoes chemical reactivity. Specifically related to the MRSAC program, my role is to make systems that are called fueled systems that drive the materials to states that are out of equilibrium. So basically one of the main goals of the MRSAC, or at least IRG1 of the MRSAC, is to generate specific new methods that do what's known as chemical fueling, where a particular material changes its properties based on the addition of a fuel. And then as that fuel is used up, or you might say burned away in a certain manner of speaking, the material transitions back to its original form or even transitions maybe to a new material.
Do you have any examples of this that come like maybe directly from nature?
Oh, absolutely. Because nature is always out of equilibrium. We're constantly being fueled, if I can use that term. We eat food, we take in sunlight, we breathe in oxygen. All of these are acting as fuels that run the assemblies of our body, generate our cells, generate the molecules involved in proteins and nucleic acids, etc. And it is considered out of equilibrium in the sense that it's constantly needing fuel to be able to maintain. And if you don't, basically, you die, which is, in essence, in an analogy, it's going back to equilibria at that stage.
That's been a running theme, I think, in the MRSAC podcast, as we talk to a lot of our chemical engineering and some of our physics faculty about the kind of state of equilibrium in the body and how fascinating that is.
Yeah, I think IRG1 is mostly focused, it seems like, on almost mimicking like biological phenomena, which I think is really cool.
In many ways, that's exactly the way to describe it. I've worked in areas all the way back to my postdoc, you would say, so over 36 years ago, of trying to mimic Mother Nature in a variety of ways, trying to mimic Mother Nature's ways to catalyze reactions, working currently to mimic Mother Nature's ways of storing information and transferring information. And again, to reiterate, IRG1, trying to mimic Mother Nature's ways of fueling out of equilibrium assemblies that are really quite analogous to life in many ways.
So your work is quite interdisciplinary. One example being your group's work using a software called MOL-E-Coder to encode Jane Austen's Mansfield Park and the script of The Wizard of Oz in chemical groups discovered by your group. Would you mind expanding on that a little more?
Sure. It's probably one of my favorite projects at the moment.
Perfect.
So I already alluded to mimicking Mother Nature. And I even alluded to information storage and transfer. So, you know, life on planet Earth, encoded in a base 4 mathematical system, that is our nucleic acids, where there's 4 symbols that humans call A, T, C, and G. And it's the sequence of those symbols that are the genetic codes of all life on this planet that basically encode the ability to make the machines, such as proteins, and make materials, such as skin and bone, and et cetera, that make up life on this planet. But it's a series of symbols, as I alluded to, within a string of nucleic acid. Well, humankind, of course, stores information as a series of symbols too. Morse code, as an example. English language, there's 26 symbols. Of course, it's more complicated. There's lowercase, uppercase, there's punctuation, and et cetera. But it's a series of symbols in a string that basically communicates, stores and communicates information. So our group has devised a series of symbols in what are known as polyurethanes. It's a polymer where all the side chains act as the symbology in this chemical language that can store information. And you already said, you know, I encoded a encryption key to open up the book, The Wizard of Oz, simply because I love The Wizard of Oz, a 1900 book by L. Frank Baum. Love the 1939 MGM movie starring Judy Garland. But I also love Jane Austen. I've read probably every single one of her novels. Well, there are only six, but I've read them probably three times each. And so it was natural for us to just have some fun with our chemistry and encode things that are kind of even just, you'd say, part of my hobbies.
I love that, bringing some fun into the work.
I try to do that all the time in my work.
Yeah, for sure. I think if you've listened to our previous episodes with Dr. Wasserman, we kind of talk about how we really like it when professors really like go out of their way to try to include things that wouldn't necessarily be considered like hard science, if that makes sense. Just because I think we're just firm believers in the classical education. So appreciation for the arts and whatnot. So I think it's super fun.
Well, I fully agree. A lot of my hobbies are totally outside of the realm of science. And just being able to bring those into science, I think, helps to make the area more approachable and more familiar to numerous people.
Yeah, it definitely kind of enhances the science communication side of things, makes it more understandable and, within reach of a broader audience.
Yeah. I write this small series of articles called Eric's Corners that are published in the journal Supramolecular Chemistry. And Eric's Corners are a chance for me to get kind of quite personal and discuss science from a vantage point of my childhood, my hobbies, television programs that are very popular, such as Game of Thrones. And, you know, it's just another way of taking science and trying to make it more adaptable to a wider audience.
I really relate to that. One of my favorite nonfiction books is a Richard Feynman biography. And it is similar to that. It is just little tidbits of him talking about the kind of random parts of science he's found in his life outside of the, you know, major nuclear engineering he was working on.
Yes.
I really connected with that because science isn't always just the big science we do. It's often some of the small stuff.
I fully agree. Yeah. And love Richard Feynman, of course.
I guess, could you give us a little sneak peek of maybe something you've included in one of your corners?
Well, actually, the most recent one was all about fueling. If we go back to what IRG1 is discussing, what is a fuel? Fuel is a chemical, usually, not always. There's sunlight, that's a fuel. Even the weights in a grandfather clock are a fuel. But, you know, as a chemist, I think of it as a chemical. That by virtue of a chemical reaction it performs will create a force. Now I'm starting to become more like a physicist. And once you have a force, it creates a movement of some kind. And so I tried to just relate fuels back to, in this Eric corner, everyday life, such as how an internal combustion motor works in your cars, but then tie it to chemically actually driving biology out of equilibrium, kind of coming full circle to what we discussed earlier in this podcast.
Yeah, I really like how you're trying to draw analogies between very different subjects. I think that's always really exciting. And there's definitely plenty of analogies to be had. I guess in the past, are there any chemistry or chemistry analogies that have particularly stuck with you where you've thought wow, this is a really good one?
So you mean an analogy between something in chemistry and everyday life? I mean, help me understand exactly what direction you want me to go in here.
Oh, yeah. I just mean like an analogy like between everyday life or even just like the analogy that you brought up with the Carnot cycle and stuff. I guess it's really broad.
Well, that's pretty broad. But, you know, I'm going to say when I teach physical organic chemistry. Okay. So I always talk a little bit about quantum mechanics and make an analogy of waves that form atomic and molecular orbitals and their energies to the waves that we can all relate to in our everyday lives, such as waves in a swimming pool. And when I look at the mathematics that are involved in quantum mechanics, you know, to make it more approachable, yes, I do try to make an analogy to basically you and your buddies jumping in a swimming pool and what happens to the waves as they intersect with one another, how they add and subtract, and how the energies of those waves change. And I think, just a great analogy of how molecules form and how atoms come together to make more stable structures by basically lowering the energy of the wave functions involved in quantum mechanics.
I love talking about quantum mechanics. It's just such a broad topic sometimes, because you could be talking on the atomic level, but then it can kind of also go up to this really giant like astrophysics level, which is where I was studying for a period of time.
I love quantum mechanics too. I took a ton of it when I was an undergrad. I'm pretty removed from it now, but yes, I thought it was just one of the more fun classes I took.
It's just such a blast. I wanted to move on to discuss your kind of career journey, because you have a really fascinating one. You were about to go to medical school, it sounded like, before you pivoted to pursue your PhD in organic chemistry. What happened that helped you make that switch? What caused that decision, I guess?
Yeah, I was pre-med all through undergrad.
All through undergrad.
You might even call me a classic grade-grubbing pre-med.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I would never say that out loud.
But I did. I'm happy to admit to it.
Yeah.
And I did go to medical school. Got accepted to a couple. I went to University of Southern California Medical School. Now, I was only there for 2 weeks.
Oh.
I dropped out of med school and went back to my undergraduate institute and did what you'd now probably call a gap year, where I did research in organic chemistry for another year. Yeah, that was a pretty emotional time. My parents were super supportive of me pulling out, because they could tell that really what I wanted to do was be an organic chemist. I'd kind of learned that throughout my undergraduate career, taking organic chemistry, fell in love with it kind of instantly, because it related a lot to my hobbies. I could talk about that later if you want. But point being, I knew, God, I really love organic chemistry. And when I went to med school, I'm sure I would have loved to be a physician. It's a wonderful career. But I had this epiphany that, no, I don't want to do this. I'm going to really be an organic chemist. So withdrew. And like I say, here I am.
That's awesome. I think I don't really hear the phrase, God, I love organic chemistry so much. So I feel like if you do think that thought, maybe switching from med school to organic chemistry might be a good idea.
Right.
You mentioned some of your hobbies, like relating to organic chemistry. I guess for me, when I think of organic chemistry, I just think of like arrow pushing. So do you want to elaborate on kind of like what hobbies you were talking about?
Well, yeah, there is a lot of arrow pushing. No doubts. So organic chemistry, we design molecules, we synthesize, we build those molecules where they are aimed to perform some function or some task. In the pharma area, you know, Bristol Myers Squibb, Merck, Upjohn, all of these companies are designing drugs, designing the actual detailed chemical structure of that organic compound to elicit some biological response and, you know, help with disease. So you're building a chemical structure to perform a function. Going back to IRG1, we build chemicals to act as fuels to perform the functions of transforming one material property into another. Okay, so now with that, you know, what did I do as a boy? I built go-karts.
Yeah.
I still work on cars. I built a lot of models, you know, plastic models, balsa wood airplanes, etc. I was always just basically creating something with my hands that was designed to have fun in the backyard, but really designed to perform some kind of function or task. And it's really, I kind of am doing pretty much the same thing now in my career, except it's on a nanoscopic scale, so I can't visually play with it, but I can study it to see if it's performing the function or task that, you know, we designed it for.
Did you ever get a chance to play with the those chemistry models?
The ball and stick models?
Yes.
Yes. even to this day.
Yeah.
So, again, as an organic chemist, if you go into my office right now and look at my desk, it's filled with what are called CPK models, which are basically very sophisticated versions of ball and stick models. Yeah, so I still build those models of the exact molecules that we're making in our laboratories.
I find this very relatable as the child of chemists, because those were in my like toy box growing up, the ball and stick models. And so thinking about this connection to your childhood is really nostalgic for me as well.
Fantastic. I think we're all kind of influenced very much by our childhood and what directions it takes us. Yeah.
Oh, 1,000%.
Dang, your toy box is wild.
Mine did not have that. It was a mix of ball and stick models and Barbies. It was a fascinating
nice. Very cool.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. How did you find this kind of transition between like organic chemistry into the kind of material science that you find yourself doing nowadays?
I don't know that it was much of a transition. Let me put it that way. It's being asked by groups of people to take the expertise that my own knowledge base, but also the expertise that my research group has, and apply it in a new area. If I look back over my career, a whole lot of what we've done was in response to someone else asking, Eric, I've got this problem. I need to solve it. Can you give us a solution to this? Can you devise some organic chemistry that will function in the way that we need it? And that's really how this project arose. It was going back to Delia Milliron, Tom Truscott, when IRG1 was originally being formulated, and they kind of knew me as an organic chemist and said, you know, I need these methods that will allow us to assemble our nanoparticles. Do you have a toolbox of things you can do in your lab to assist us? And of course, I'm going to say yes. and we got together as a group and devised the chemistry they needed. So it was really in response to them asking me to do something.
That reminds me of what you always say. The C in MRSEC stands for collaboration.
Absolutely.
And
I'm not,
the more we do this podcast, the more I'm learning how deeply that collaborative spirit runs in a lot of our work.
In my own case, almost every project in our group, in some manner or other, is collaborative with the people who originally sought us to go in the direction that we're moving. You know, I get these ideas, inspirations from people. I write grants to the NSF or the NIH, raise money, and then start to solve other people's problems using organic chemistry, actually. It's a good overarching picture of how my career has played out. Yeah.
I guess you could say it's also been fueled by ideas.
Yeah, yeah, by other people's ideas. It's not always me. My ideas primarily come into how to get the organic chemistry to do what we want it to do.
Mm.
Right.
You talked about your hobbies, and they kind of piqued my curiosity. So you started working on go-karts. And by go-kart, you mean like the ones that you might do at like a putt-putt golf course, right? Or was it?
What kind of go-kart?
Oh.
Yeah. Okay.
What kind of go-kart?
Full-fledged racing go-karts.
Yeah.
Okay. Not little putt-putt carts.
No.
I mean, I love putt-putt carts. Yeah. I mean, I do go out to COTA here in town. They have a kart racetrack, and they're pretty good go-karts. But yeah, these were go-karts I built and drove them around my backyard. We built dirt racetracks in my backyard. This was my neighbor, Brian Heidsick, and I, good friend even to this day. So we put together the go-karts. We had welding kits. You know, I have all of my tools still, and bought motors out of lawnmowers, you know, engines out of lawnmowers, and put them on a go-kart frame and connected it up with chains and gears. And pretty soon you got a little car that drives around. But that led us into more professional go-kart racing. I did go-kart racing, for decades.
Wow.
I just sold my last go-kart during COVID because I just wasn't going to the racetrack anymore.
Yeah. And this has translated to, like, larger street legal car maintenance and development?
So I've always worked on cars. Okay. Again, all the way back to my childhood. Yeah. And I still work on and restore cars to this day.
Ever find any of these mechanical engineering opportunities in your organic chemistry work?
No, I don't know. I just make analogies constantly between what I'm doing in a car.
Yeah.
In fact, my class today said, "Eric, show us your cars." You know, I got out my iPhone and I called up and picked some of the cars. So I just make these analogies to how cars operate. How does the internal combustion engine motor operate? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of coming full circle to our discussion of fuels earlier.
Awesome. Would you mind sharing one of the analogies you maybe have shared with your class?
So, you know, you talk about fuels in your automobile. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about an electric car now, even though I could, but I'm really talking about an internal combustion motor. The fuel, of course, is the hydrocarbon that you pump into your gas tank when you pull into Chevron, Mobil, or Exxon, whatever. But it's also mixed with oxygen in the air, and then it's burned in the internal combustion motor. So what's the fuel means that it's unstable. The chemical structure is unstable when in the presence of oxygen relative to its products. I'm getting kind of technical here, but relative to its products, which are water and carbon dioxide. So when it burns, it releases energy, releases heat. And that heat is what drives the pistons down in your motor and turns a crankshaft that ultimately transitions all the way back and turns the wheels and the tires. So it's all due to chemical instability in the fuel that causes this motion to occur in your car. Well, there's chemical instability, you would say, in the food we eat, that we consume, that can react with oxygen that we breathe, that ultimately leads to driving chemical reactions in our body that generate movement. I mean, even like me moving my arm here with my muscles contracting. So it's all the same idea of energy that is stored within a chemical that in some manner is allowed to be released to drive some other process.
It's interesting to think about. We've heard so many different analogies for our bodily functions. And so it's really fascinating to hear how we might be like a car. And
it's just a different fuel and and the function is extremely different. Yes.
And we're putting different fuels in to fuel different parts of our car as well to some extent.
Yeah, of course.
Like we've got our carbohydrates for our brain function and we've got our protein for our muscle development.
Oh, yeah.
I guess are there any kind of like any of these chemical instabilities that you've been looking into recently in terms of kind of taking advantage of maybe prompting them into a non-equilibrium state?
There's two projects ongoing in our group oriented towards these non-equilibrium material assemblies that are the focus of IRG1. One is a metal coordination, so now I'm going to get pretty technical again, where the nanoparticles or the materials are held together by coordination complexes around cobalt 2. And as we add chloride from a fuel source, it ends up breaking up those complexes, causing this material transformation. But then going further, if you have a secondary coupled chemical reaction that can scavenge the chloride, it takes the chloride back into another form, and now the material comes back to its original property. So this is us basically mimicking the idea of taking in a fuel, watching assembly change its structure, but then as the fuel runs out, coming back to the analogy of kind of, maybe it's a morbid analogy, but an analogy to death, it's the system comes back to its original state. It's no longer fueled out of equilibria.
That's really cool. I feel like it's not as morbid as a death analogy just because there is resurrection, right?
Yeah, there is in this case.
If you add it back,
if
it'll
you
come
add
back.
More chloride, it's it comes back alive. Okay. Sure.
It's
I'm going to remember that, actually, because I think that'll help me describe it a little better than I do. Thank you.
Well, it's so important to acknowledge, you know, the cycle of life is extremely important
yes.
to the continued existence of life. And so no matter how morbid death is, it's still beautiful.
Well, okay. I'm buying into it.
Yeah. As long as we're all buying into it, that's what matters.
That's really cool. You mentioned the second project. Is it kind of similar in terms of like
extremely similar, except it has to do with, again, now I'm getting into organic chemistry, conjugate additions with nucleophilic thiols. And then the thiols get scavenged and the material reassembles. But the spirit of the idea is pretty much identical, but using different chemical systems.
Yeah, I can see how it's pretty modular sounding.
That's our goal, is to try to make it very modular so that other chemists around the world can adopt it to their systems.
Wow, that's so welcoming and accessible.
I'm always trying to do things that will help facilitate all my colleagues around the world. Yeah.
It's like changing parts on a car.
Yeah. That's a great analogy, too. Yeah.
What I'm learning is today's the analogy day.
This is where my brain's at.
So I wanted to also touch on something specifically you'd said in an interview with the Royal Society of Chemistry. You'd advised young people that were exploring careers in chemistry to not give into the peer review process. Would you mind elaborating on this?
Oh.
It's okay if not.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to elaborate. Yeah, great question. What I meant by not give into the peer review process is don't get discouraged. I mean, you have to go along with the peer review process. It's the way our careers work. But it can be pretty discouraging. You get your grants declined. You get your papers declined. A whole lot of it is keeping that confidence that you know you're doing good work and you fight against the system. You don't let it beat you down. So there's a lot of success derived from this career just being persistent and not letting yourself kind of die off because the job is difficult. It is a difficult job when, you know, you've worked so hard. You've written this grant. You think it's the best thing. Oh, wow. How can they not fund this?
Yeah.
And then it's not funded. Okay. So, you know, I'm always upset. I will be. I'll go home and my wife was, oh, God, Eric, your grant wasn't funded. She can tell, you know. but you got to come back to resurrection. You got to come back to life and go at it again. Just don't let it beat you down. Don't give in.
Do you have a method for cultivating this kind of academic resilience in your graduate students or even your undergrads?
Telling them it's all worthwhile and you have to just keep pushing because it is ultimately all worthwhile. It's one of the best jobs there is, this job, being a professor. And again, I love organic chemistry. We're back to where I started. It's great to be a professor of this discipline. It's all worth the while. It's all worth the effort.
Yeah, no matter what reviewer number two says, paper is good.
That's exactly right. There's always reviewer two.
There's always reviewer two.
How do we overcome reviewer two?
Exactly.
Are there any like tips and tricks you'd have for people who are struggling with reviewer two?
Okay, but you do have to step back and say, okay, the proverbial reviewer two. Yeah, probably there's some fault there on your own. that maybe you didn't communicate it as well as you could have in the paper. You didn't make the point solid enough that reviewer two was able to pick up on it. Or very often, reviewer two thinks of something you didn't think of, which is the way that's where the peer review process is supposed to work in that way. So you just regroup, rewrite it so it is clearer, and the peer review process always does end up improving your manuscript. It always does end up improving your grants, too. Now, I think in the case of grants, when they're not funded and you have to rewrite them, there is a point of diminishing return. The first two times you rewrite or something, you pretty much got this polished. And if it's not getting funded, it's simply because funding agencies and the federal government just doesn't have enough money to really fund everything that's still great work. And you kind of just have to accept the reality of that too. Right. There's limited resources, and no matter what we do.
What was the chemical that you put back into the system to revive it? From earlier? Was it chlorine?
Oh, chloride.
Chloride.
In that earlier case.
So Sometimes when you get these grant reviews back or these paper reviews back, you just need to put some chloride back in your system.
There's another analogy.
It was cooking.
Do not do that to your body, to be clear.
You always have to regroup. Yeah. Take reviewer two or whatever at face value and do your best to respond appropriately. Always be really polite in your responses. Yeah. I'm quite sure there's many a time I've been the reviewer too. Where on the other side, they're thinking, oh my God, what's this person thinking? But, you know, I do my very best to be a good reviewer, and reviewer too, when reviewing our paper, and maybe it didn't come back glowing, was doing their best also.
Yeah, for sure. In the end, we are all reviewer too.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, and that's also just a general life philosophy, is if you approach both being the reviewer and the receiver with kindness, there's always bound to be some growth to come out of it.
I'm a big proponent of, let's not get angry. Let's just all respect one another. Let's work together. Even though you don't know who the person is, but you are working with them in an indirect manner to revise your paper, revise your grant, and do better science.
I'd like to bring this back to the MRSEC for a bit. Do you think any of this speaks to the collaborative spirit within the MRSEC?
In the sense that we all really are driving towards a common goal, I would say yes. The focus of the MRSEC is, again, on making these non-equilibrium fueled assemblies, and that is the common goal that's being approached from multiple angles, synthetic organic chemistry in my own case, material science and many of the other collaborators, chemical biology, computational chemistry, physical chemistry with lasers, and yeah, we just have a composite of professors all coming at this one problem from multiple different vantage points. And that's a pretty exciting part of what, you know, we're able to accomplish by having a MRSEC.
It's like a rainbow of fuel.
Of course. Yeah. Rainbow of approaches to fueling.
Yes.
There we go.
I love that.
So typically when we come to the end of our talk, we like to circle back to the theme of the podcast for the season. So for this season, it's kind of just asking all of our guests, you know, like, is there a new research topic or a new material, chemistry, et cetera, that you're really excited about for like the future of material science?
Yes, there. I'm now the director of a Center for Chemical Innovation. It's funded by the NSF. It's for creating materials that replicate. Imagine a piece of plastic that can create more of itself, put it that way. Much like nucleic acids replicate, they're polymeric materials that can make copies of themselves. We're working on polymeric materials that, you know, we hope, we have not achieved this, but we hope will replicate themselves. And therefore, on some level, that's a small part of the analogy of what is the definition of life. There's multiple different things that create there's lots of debate. Not everybody agrees what life is and how to define it. But certainly one thing that's almost always part of the definition of life is the ability to replicate and make copies of itself. So if we can make plastics that replicate and grow upon damage, imagine that structure wherever it broke not only self-heals, but kind of grows and becomes stronger at the place where the fission originally occurred. Much like your skin, you get cut, repairs itself and grows, and you get a scar, so to speak. Yeah, this is a new area of work in our group that I'm pretty excited about.
Would you mind speaking more to the applications of materials like these?
Well, so now we can get into the science fiction applications because we're nowhere really near doing this.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, solar panels degrade with time by being in the sun. So could you make a self-healing, resilient solar panel? I already alluded to analogies to skin growing scars. I really do mean if you had plastic materials that broke and fractured, instead of just healing themselves at that fracture, they actually strengthen. It's what's known as an anti-fragile material. It's one that heals itself, but then becomes even stronger where the original deformation occurred. Like I said, lots of groups envision this, but this has not been achieved by any, you know, real groups around the world, but it is kind of a new frontier for material science.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Yeah, that's exactly what the point of the question is to get to, is those like pie in the sky type, like,
yeah,
we're going to make this thing. It's going to be so cool. So, anyway, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's all for today's episode of the Materials Universe podcast. Thank you for listening to our interesting conversations with inspiring guests from different fields of science and engineering. We hope you enjoyed learning something new. Please leave us a review and share this podcast with friends. You can follow us on social media at TexasCDCM on Instagram and X. Thank you to the National Science Foundation and the University of Texas at Austin, and an additional thank you to the Late's Audio Studio crew for their help with the production of this podcast.